Committee on Environment and Land Use. Boy, that was good timing. And we will reopen our public hearing on House Bill 2137. I might mention that if you signed up at the previous meeting on Tuesday, you have to re-sign again to speak today. So, and we have the list up here. We have another list back there right now. So, if you would like to speak to the committee today, please sign the sign-up sheet, witness registration form that is in the rear of the building.
Who's Tom Wendt?
Let's see. So we'll begin accepting testimony, and I'll ask Gene and Barbara Preet, who have come the longest distance today from Deschutes County. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. And welcome.
Thank you.
My name is Gene Preet. We live in Sisters. And I basically want to explain our situation, a small example of what we feel is a big problem. And I think our situation can be multiplied perhaps thousands of times around the state. A little background, we bought a 20-acre parcel in Deschutes County in 1990 with the idea that some future time when we could retire, we were going to move on the parcel and build a retirement home. And so we purchased it, made payments, and at the time the land was divided into five parcels, and we bought a 20. There were four of the parcels. Went through a percolation test. The lot was totally buildable at that time. It's an EFU property, but there was minimal farm activity required to be able to have a farmhouse there. As I say, the retirement date in the future was unknown, but we were assured that, whenever you can, you move up here and you can build your retirement home. There's nothing to worry about. And as time went on, things happened, like the $80,000 rule got into place, which effectively just shut the door on us. What got us so upset is that there was no notification that things were happening and changing that were going to affect our property rights. But we got some notification a year or whatever, some kind of lead time here. We would have done something, obviously, to secure our right to build a home. Well, that didn't happen. In the last several years, we put a great deal of money into this property, and we feel all of it is farm-related. The whole idea is to save farmland. So our question is, save it from what? Save it from who? We have a community pond. There's four parcels on this pond. It was necessary to install a new pump, about 2,000 feet of new main line. We had to repair exterior fencing. We did cross fencing. We installed a domestic well. We brought in the electric power some 300 feet from the road. We built a small barn with hay storage, three stalls, tack room, and a wash area. And meanwhile, we've been also purchased a wheel line. We've been actively weed control, fertilizing. Anyway, using the property as farm activity. So everything we've done was farm has been farm related. We decided that despite what things we've heard, we were going to apply for a conditional use permit in Deschutes County. And we were optimistic that based on our situation, the fact that our parcel is an island for which there are other homes all around us engaged in some degree of farm activity, that surely another home on 20 acres is not going to disrupt anything. It would blend right in. It would make good use of the land. So we went ahead and we've spent money on some advice from attorneys, land use specialists, and we thought, surely there's going to be some logic involved here, and we're going to submit this conditional use permit. Well, we did. And the lowest level of staff member denied it based on an $80,000 rule, based on we didn't have trees, rocks, etc. So therefore, we can't build a home. In the application, we had at least a dozen letters from all of our immediate neighbors, the adjacent neighbors and the ones within, you know, half a mile away, all in support of us building a home there. There would be no conflict. And one of the negative points was that they used a two-mile radius test, and there were five other similar parcels. They said, well, if we let you build a house here, these other people may want to build a house too. Well, you know, and the fact is, if you have these houses as spread apart as they are, and based on the activity that's going on there, there would be no impact. We have 14 acres of water and six dry. Once again, logically, you could take a portion of one of the six dry acres and build a house. Their position is, no, even though you can't water the six dry, it's still considered usable farmland. If any of you are familiar with that farmland, you know, you could raise a couple of cuttings of grass, hay, and graze some cattle, but it's marginal at best compared to the west side. And also, in recent years, we've been down to like 30% water allocation. So what we feel is that there's a whole buildup of negatives here which prevent us from building a house which cannot be overcome by us. I told the county that, well, hey, we have 14 acres of water. Logically, you'd say, based on your situation, there are three things you might do as far as farm activity, whether it be livestock or whatever. So based on your small operation, your 14 acres of water, you can do one of these three things. And if you do, you'd be contributing to farm activity, and it would be just dandy. You can build a house because you're not doing something totally adverse to what the land is hopefully to be used for. And I told him, why don't you come up with some options here for us? Well, there are no options. And that land, before we bought it, sat idle for many, many years. It wasn't watered, fertilized, weed control, nothing. So all we've done is improve it. If we were able to live on the land, we could provide additional improvements and be more active in some farm activity. We have a couple of horses, and we had some feeder cattle on the property this past season. But we're rather limited as to how far you can go based on the fact that we're having to support two properties. I figure that the value of the property has decreased by at least $250,000. It's a nice piece of property with a good westward view of the mountains. What it's worth if you can't build a house on it is anybody's guess, and including the local tax assessor. I asked them. Well, they couldn't tell me what is it worth. So it's been a very long and disappointing experience. We feel that the intent of Measure 7 has to be implemented some way, somehow. But I hear discussion even last Tuesday morning about this is a very complex issue. Well, we didn't do anything to create this complex issue. And one of the people testifying Tuesday said, well, if you implement this intent of Measure 7, that, you know, they have a lot of problems in the city to try to accommodate them. Well, hey, you know, we're talking about basic property rights here. And all these other obstacles have got to be overcome somehow or another. Measure 7 or the intent of is not going to go away. There are a lot of people out there that we talk to over in Central Oregon who are caught up, and they just have no idea, you know, why the rules are as they are. Surely when you buy a piece of property, other rules come along which are necessary, logical, or whatever that I could totally agree with. But how do you not grandfather existing properties into, you know, so that we could conform to the existing rules at the time we bought the property? Rather than making a new rules and $80,000, it's just somebody's idea to shut the door, because it's impossible to do that. I have 21 years in military service, and my wife was saying, you know, maybe something is going to happen where we can't. And I said, it's just not possible. I cannot believe the day will come when we can retire, we're ready to build a home, and we're going to get rejected. And sure enough, we did. And there's no help by the local officials. We're going to open a page in the book and say, well, here's the reason why you can't do it. No suggestions on how to get around it, you know, and make it work. So, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for serving your country, by the way. Any questions from the committee?
Sir, I have a question.
Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You said you were assured that you could build on it when you bought it in 1990. What sort of assurances did you have? Where did those assurances come from?
We're not really knowledgeable in land use, but we had a percolation test. We were told we have to do this because, you know, you want to be sure that when you build your house, you have adequate septic and whatever. And a couple of years later, the parcel next door sold. They built a house. They went through the process, and we saw that. And that was prior to 93. So, why should we not believe that we could build a house when someone else did it after we bought a property there? So we said, well, okay, they built one, and when we get ready and can have, you know, the time is right, we can afford it, we will do the same thing.
But when you bought it, did you check with the county or other people? I mean, were they telling you at that time that it was appropriate for residential construction?
They were allowing building permits.
What's that?
They were allowing building permits.
Well, yeah. I did not talk to an official as such, but they were allowing building permits. We talked to other people in the area. We saw what was going on. People were building. So I don't have an official letter or anything, but that's what I thought we found out at the time.
Thank you.
Representative, the chair would request that you request a follow-up question.
I'm sorry.
You repeat yourself. Representative Zoner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gene and Barbara, thanks for coming over. I hope the roads were bare and you didn't have any snow. I think you're okay. What's the $80,000 rule, Gene, that you mentioned? Can you explain that a little bit for me?
One of the obstacles of you can build a farmhouse on the property, but you have to show $80,000 a year in farm activity in dollars, and you've got to do it 2 years prior to the time when you get a permit. If you can't do that, you can't build a farmhouse. So we went in with a non-farmhouse request. Well, you can't do that either because you don't have outcroppings and you don't have, you know, our 20 acres is you can grow, you know, marginal hay crops on the whole thing, but went ahead anyway because we thought, well, if you've got 6 acres you can't ever water, surely, you know, you can use a part of that to build a house.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
And the length of time and the cost maybe that you've invested in trying to build a house, when did you start actually, how many years you've been working on it? And
we've been working on it for probably at least 7 years, you know, in various degrees. We've spent over $100,000 in farm-related activities, that list I mentioned earlier. Okay. All because we were optimistic that there's going to be some way to build a house, and so we went ahead and made the improvements on the land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again.
Gene, I'm going to ask you a couple questions. If you don't care to respond to the, to give the answer, that's fine. Because they may be of a personal nature to you. What were the surrounding plot sizes of the property adjacent to yours?
The one behind us was the 20. The one to the right is, I think it's 60, and the one beyond that was another 20. I think there was one behind us that was
30. There was a 20, a 20, what? A 20, and a 30. I'm sorry.
Yeah. They weren't all 20s. They were some a little larger, but there were two other 20s and then two other parcels that were maybe 40 or larger.
Is there farming on each plot existing at the moment? In other words, all around you, is everybody else farming something?
Well, neighbor to our right has about 2 cuttings of grass, say, a year. The neighbor on the other side of us this past season brought in some cattle to graze from somebody else owned just for so many dollars a head to graze the thing. neighbor in the back has a couple of cuttings of grass there. So there is some activity, but, you know, none of them, if they had to pass this test today, could pass it.
And none of them, to your knowledge, to the best of your knowledge, are any of your neighbors complying with the 80,000 rule? You got to have a few more grass cuttings than two to hit 80,000.
Yes, but, right.
Where do you get your water? You mentioned you had 14 acres of...
Yeah, there's a pond in the immediate proximity that four property owners can pump from the irrigation water, which is supplied by Squaw Creek Irrigation.
Okay. The land was zoned EFU when you originally purchased it?
Yes.
And you were aware of the rules regarding EFU land at that time, time you bought it?
Yes.
And this is, here's the first personal question. What did you originally pay for the land?
$105,000.
And what's the present assessment?
All I can do is what I see, you know, of other properties that are buildable, and they would easily be over the $300,000 mark with no improvements.
Now this, here comes another personal one. If this law, as it was passed in November 2000, were in effect today, what would your claim be?
Just to issue my permit to build a house.
That's all you want?
No, that's right. That's right. We're not looking for any monetary settlement.
Thank you. Any other questions of the committee? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for coming so far to share your story with us today. I wonder if you could just describe the appeals process that you went through. I mean, I know you're not probably technical experts, but just what were the levels of appeal that you experienced?
I guess it was a basic county process because we couldn't afford to go beyond that. And so... when you go through the initial staff, you have to sign a staff member of the county, the planning department, to look at your application. And that's after you pay that fee, you end up with a 13-page document. On the back page, it says the word denial. If you want to go further, you go to a hearing officer. The hearing officer basically looks at the, you know, the same reason the staff denied it, and there's nothing else new we could introduce. And so she denies it as well. We then asked that we could talk to the county commissioners. We thought that this body of three people might look at it a little bit differently than just a list of regulations in a book. Well, they refused to hear it because we're not exactly sure why. They just refused to hear it. They felt that they could do nothing about it, or I don't know. But that's as far as we could go. We can't afford to go any further.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow.
Did you have legal representation in this process, or you did?
Yes.
So a final follow-up. Were you advised then by your lawyer that it would be pointless to try to appeal it further, or was it just too expensive?
Both. Yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Ackerman.
I just may have two questions, one for clarification. Is it your testimony that the $80,000 rule came into effect after you purchased the property? Is that what I understand?
Yes.
And I assume that that was without any notice to you as the landowner?
Correct.
Okay. And just one additional question. With respect to the home you intended to build, could you give me an idea of how much square feet would be involved along with any accessory buildings which you would had planned?
Maybe in the neighborhood of 2,500 feet, and we already have the barn, small barn, and that would be about it. So, about 2,500.
And I assume that in this situation, your home could be so sited not to take any farm uses out of production or out of utility. Would that be correct?
Yes, because with the Squaw Creek irrigation, we submitted an irrigation map and overlay on the 20 acres, and it was designed such that we could utilize the 14 acres of water we have, and the house would go on a portion of one of the six dry acres.
Thank you.
Any other questions from any other committee members? Seeing none, Gene and Barbara, and I'll pronounce your name correctly this time. Pate?
Pate, yes.
Thank you for coming all the way from the Deschutes County area to tell your story. I believe it's indicative of many of the frustrations that exist from property owners in the state today. Thank you for coming in here.
Can I just say?
Certainly.
I have a few notes. Thank you.
Certainly.
My name is Barbara Pretty, and thank you for hearing our story this morning. The intent of Measure 7 is not going to die. Over the ordeal of land rights being taken from us, we have met some wonderful people. And we have met some people who have loved the power they seem to have gained of dictating to people like us. The planning departments need new direction from the legislature, not just stating that you may give them the right to build their home, but that the planning departments will give us back our rights with a building status with no time limit. We were forced to buy a new place 3 or 4 miles away. We go AM and PM to feed our stock. Last year, we showed up at 3:30 to feed our horses in the afternoon, and one horse was colicking, and it was too late to save him. We most definitely feel we could do a better job if we live on our property. Our long-term goal was to be debt-free this time in our life, but now that's not the case. Letting us and others build would boost job creation in the construction field. Our representative told us many years ago that we should have been notified, but that the land use groups told the legislature it would cost them $1 million in postage and paper handling to notify all the people they were messing with. We were raised by our parents and grandparents to have good work ethics, work hard, and have the American dream. And gentlemen and ladies, that's not the case. Thank you.
Do any have any questions of Mrs. Pretty? Again, thank you both for making
thank
the
you.
Trip and telling your story this morning. Again, we're going to accept testimony first from the people who have traveled the furthest. So, Del, are you ready? Apologize if I messed up your name, Del.
That's right. I probably live the closest. The reason I'm here, I have a commercial lot property for sale in Newburg, Oregon. It's at the intersection of Highway 99 and Springbrook Road. I've had 4 or 5 offers to purchase the property. They have all rescinded because of problems of access. We have been denied access to 99W through condemnation many years ago. Currently, access is obtained by the 200-foot offset from 99. And my most recent purchaser wanted to build a family restaurant on this location. They withdrew and advised that although there is full access from the right or left at this time, that it is the intention of the city and the highway department to extend a median that would totally eliminate the left in or left out. Talking to the appraiser that I have had appraise the property, this is a licensed commercial appraisal, he indicates that that automatically would be a loss of 25% of value. And my thought after reading the articles in the newspaper yesterday, there is the possibility of remedy other than financial remuneration for loss of use. And I'm kind of here out of curiosity to see if some regulations could not be permitted that would permit us to have a full right in and right out, left in, left out, as opposed to going to great extent trying to avoid the loss of value. The loss of that value would be well in excess of $100,000. And this may or may not be the proper place to make this pitch, but I'm curious enough that I want to take advantage of your experience, if I can, to make some kind of allowance that an established commercial zone property be fully utilized. And thank you for your tolerance of my being here. I hope that I know when you think of land use, it usually refers to swamps and all kinds of things and farm use, but I just have a small acre and a half commercial property, and I simply want to be granted full use of that property. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very familiar with Newburgh. I lived over there in Parrot Mountain for 10 years. Is that lot across from the drive-in theater? Is it
the drive-in theater? The drive-in theater has me surrounded on two sides. Okay. Springbrook Road and 99 are the other borders, and I'm directly across Springbrook Road from Fred Meyer's.
I know they repaved everything. Are they still trying to think
that,
of cutting off running
that has been completed, and in part it was my reason for not trying to sell this property a number of years ago. I thought it would be better to sell it as fully improved, and we gave them, the highway department, additional strips of land that they could round that corner so it would be easier for 18-wheelers to make the corner.
Yeah.
And we did not ask for any excessive remuneration. I think they gave us $600, and probably would have given it to them if they'd asked. But we waited until that intersection was completed, additional lanes of traffic on Springbrook Road, new sets of traffic lights giving two lanes, left turn towards the city of Newburgh. And all of that improvement has been completed. I was elated when I saw that after they completed the construction, they ran the median only about 100 feet, which fell short of my access. And I presumed that I would be granted full access in and out. A national franchise for a family restaurant has just reneged on their proposal to purchase because upon application for building permits, the city of Newburgh indicated they were going to run that median all the way about two more blocks down the street to where there's going to be another street put in and a traffic light. And my only other option, and this seems to be in the unforeseeable future, the Francis Theater that you referred to, like I say, borders my south and west sides, and they show no signs of wishing to change their present development. And as a consequence, since it is not considered comparable to a mall, there is not mutual access, so I cannot have access through their property until such time as there is additional improvements there that it would be classified as a mall. And the current City of Newburgh regulations require that if it is developed as a mall, there will be mutual access.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Sir.
Representative.
If you help me visualize this, and I drive by that frequently as well, the only access now would be to come out onto Springbrook Road
that
and then turn
only.
Left onto it and then turn left or right onto Newburgh Road. Is that access available to you?
I didn't quite follow you on that.
You're bordered on the east by Springbrook Road?
Yes.
And on the north by
99? Yes.
So the only access now would be to come in off of Springbrook Road.
Yes.
So if
with a 200-foot setback. And if you're familiar with that intersection, Fred Meyer's has an access directly across the street from us.
Right. On Springbrook.
Yeah.
May I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is that better?
That's good.
Did the improvements, you said you waited to develop the land until the improvements were done?
Well, to the highway, for whatever reason, I thought that that might enhance the value of the property, to have all of the highway work completed as opposed to having a conflict, trying to develop the commercial property while the highway was being improved. And as it turns out, that may not have been a wise decision.
Me, if I may, just follow up on that
one final time.
Thank you. And did that? You have a sense. You said that not being able to make a left turn onto 99W decreased the value by about $100,000. Do you have a sense of what the increase in value was by the developments prior to that?
Before the development was made, there's a number of years have passed, but before that development was started, we received title to that property through an estate. And it was appraised at $400,000. And the most recent, with those improvements and with the passage of 10 years, it's now, we had an offer of $525,000. We actually had an offer of $575,000, but following the 911 experience, the purchaser, being a national franchisor, became scared of the economy and withdrew. And as a national firm, they had 12 pages of contingencies, so they had a way out.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Representative. Del, thank you. Obviously, points of access on highways come under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I know you must be in discussion with that department, plus the others that you've involved yourself with, but we thank you for coming this morning and presenting your testimony in regards to your situation.
I think it will not be unique as you'll experience, and I talked to the commercial appraisal that appraised my property twice, back at the time of the forming of the estate that we inherited. And again, just last year I had a new appraisal, and verbal discussion with him yesterday indicated that that loss of use for commercial traffic would result in, his estimate was 25% minimum loss of that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we would ask you, if you would please leave your name and address and where we can reach you. Representative Zorner serves on the Transportation Committee and would like to follow up with you on another basis.
Kay Finney.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, my name is Kay Finney. I live in Corbett, Oregon, and that's where the property is located that I wanted to speak to you about this morning. In 1988, we bought a 40-acre piece of property, and this is in the gorge area, but it is not in the scenic area. In fact, there's no scenic value. It is not in the route of any major highways, or any, if any kind of building was there, it would not affect any particular scenic landmark. But when we purchased this property in 1988, the zoning was multiple use forest, 38 acres. And the property was divided when we bought it, so it was confirmed with the county that it was buildable at that time. In 1993, major changes were made to Goal 5 at the LCDC level and the Multnomah County level. Now, in December of 1992, we realized that changes were going to take place, and we even went to the planning department in Multnomah County to check on our property and said, are any changes coming up going to affect our property? And they assured us that they weren't. Well, we didn't even know, and I would say we were probably much more on top of this than most people, that we didn't even know until 4 years later that as a result of those changes, they changed the zoning on our property without our notification. They changed it to commercial forest use 80 acres, which made our property not able to be built for that reason. They did include a lot of record provision. If you owned the property before 1985, it was still buildable, which didn't apply to us. The only other out that we could possibly have is on forest property. This LCD has what they call a template test, and I won't even, it's pretty complicated, but the point, so I won't go into a lot of it here. And ironically enough, our property will pass the state template test, but LCDC made the test much stricter. So now our property, which was our final option to be able to build, now because of the strictness of the template test on the county level, we cannot build. So we're toast. And we haven't taken any legal action. I do know there were two cases of properties in rural Multnomah County that had exactly the same situation that did appeal to LUBA. And I did follow those cases, and they were both denied. So the problem is, too, and I've heard this before, the problem is now you cannot buy a piece of property without having a clue what you can do. And I really am not against strict regulations on land use. But before 1993, when they imposed stricter rules, they always grandfathered in the properties that were already divided and already buildable. And that's what I feel when you buy a piece of property, you need to know what you can do. But since 1993 now, and particularly the problem with Multnomah County, too, is I know in other parts of the state, they want a lot more local control. Well, local control is killing us. I mean, we could live with LCDC, but Multnomah County is now so strict as a result of, like, our property, you can't, there's really, they can do anything they want. They can impose any kind of restriction. I did testify many times in front of the Multnomah County commissioners. They did land use plans in our rural area to try to avail that. Our property could have been made buildable. They could have provided that at Multnomah County, and it didn't happen. So the point is, I can't afford to go through a whole long attorney process, and knowing that this particular case has already been turned down by LUBA, there's no reason to pursue it. And really, this measure has become my last result.
Any questions of Ms. Finney?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative?
Just one, I wanted to make sure I understood the sequence. When your property was rezoned, did you have notice at that time?
No, we had no notification at all, okay, that they had rezoned the property.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just make a point of inquiry. This is the second piece of testimony we've heard where there's been substantial rezoning of property, apparently without notice to the landowners. I'm really worried about that. Is there any chance that we could, later on in our hearings process, hear from the agencies involved and review those notice requirements?
I think that's an excellent suggestion. I know that and Dan may be able to add something to this, but it was only between, I think, sometime after 1998 that counties were required to notify property owners. That law, I believe, went into effect sometime after 1998. I recall as a county commissioner having to deal with that issue on the basis of the cost of that notification. So it's been very recent, and we will do that, Representative Ackerman. It's a very good suggestion. Ms. Fanny, I would just ask you one question. If Measure 7 were in effect today, what would satisfy you?
Actually, that's what you do when you don't have notes. That was the number one thing I was going to say, too, to emphasize. I don't want any compensation for this property. I don't want to be compensated. I don't want it to cost the state one dime or the county one dime. I just want to be able to put a house on this property.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming in this morning.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Zoller.
You live up on the hill in Corbett?
Yeah.
Down? Okay. Second, the follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Kay, I'm concerned with length of time it takes to work through this process. How many years have you been involved in trying to solve this problem up there?
We found out these changes went into effect, so basically we checked on it, like I said, in fall of 1992. We didn't, until Multnomah County started doing a land use plan in our area, which was called the East of the Sandy River Plan, that was probably 96. So since 96 is probably the time frame that we've been actively trying to pursue how to remedy this problem.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Finney, very much. Joseph Burke. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Burke. I live in Lake Oswego.
drove down here this morning. Saw in the paper yesterday this hearing was taking place, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to present my situation. I'm a casualty of the Columbia River Gorge Commission, and in 1986 I purchased a piece of property in the Columbia River Gorge in a little community called Rowena, which is just 6 miles west of the Dalles, right on the Columbia River. This Rowena area is unique in that it contains, pretty much with one exception, the only privately owned property on the Columbia River in the mid-Columbia area. And it is not rural at this time. It is it hasn't been in a long time. It's basically a bedroom community of the Dalles. It's residential, and there are 18 properties along the river, and then any number of properties over across the old highway, residential properties, anything from trailer homes to fixed housing. And most of the people there either are retired or work in the city of the Dalles or somewhere in the area. I purchased the property as was becoming quite common with the idea of windsurfing in the Columbia River Gorge. It's, as everybody probably is aware, become a popular destination for windsurfers from around the world to come and sail on the famed winds of the Columbia River Gorge. And I bought my property with the idea of recreational use and investment, and ultimately perhaps a retirement home. The property came with a single-family house and several outbuildings, and excuse me. And it has it's deeded 5 acres. About 3.5 acres are dry. An acre and a half was flooded years ago when the dam was built, but it's still deeded ownership. Anyway, when I bought it, it had been surveyed as two parcels, but not partitioned. And at the time, it was customary not to apply for a partition until you actually wanted to sell off part of it or whatever. It was customary just to wait until you had a buyer, and then it was merely a formality to apply to the county and get your petition. The zoning at the time was 8,000 square foot lots, and as I say, I had 3.5 acres dry, so 5 acres deeded. It could have theoretically divided into quite a few lots. It was never my intention to do an 8,000 square foot subdivision, but I did envision being able to split it either in half or in fourths perhaps, and be able to, at some point with rising values in the area, be able to recoup my original investment and have enough to build a little custom home of my own and have some neighbors that I would enjoy recreating in the area with. In 1987, a moratorium was placed on doing any partition, and several of my neighbors who were smart enough and saw this coming applied for their partitions prior to that moratorium, and in fact there are any number of parcels along there where homes are now built on a quarter of an acre. Once that moratorium was placed, the opportunity to merely follow the formality and get your partition ended, and subsequently when the guidelines for the scenic area were implemented, the county was more or less pressured into enforcing these guidelines, and they changed the zoning without any notice to us, of course, to minimum 5 acre zoning. So I went from 8,000 square foot zoning to minimum 5 acre zoning, effectively 25 times the minimum lot size in the area, and that's the way it was left. So now I'm in a position, and have been, where I have to maintain a 5 acre parcel of land. The taxes out there are quite high, as is the cost of maintaining the property. We don't live there full time. We live in Lake Oswego, and we travel out there in the summertime to sail. For the benefit of that, I pay about $10,000 a year in property tax, and another $10,000 probably in maintenance of the area. And where I would like to be able to divide the property, in order to continue owning the property, I took a partner some years back because the cost of ownership was just becoming exorbitant for the amount of use that we get out of it. So I took on a partner, and that has made it possible to continue to own the property. But ideally, I would have preferred to have simply divided it in half and sold off half of it, or perhaps in fourths, as I say, and sold off three-fourths of it, and just kept enough to be able to do my recreation in the area and build a retirement home and not have so much property to pay taxes on and maintain. This new bill, which I just saw in the paper yesterday, gives people like me hope whose rights as a landowner have been usurped by the state and the government and the county, and allow us. I'm not looking for any kind of compensation like the others. I'd just like to be able to have the rights to use the property as was represented to me when I purchased it in 1986. I'd like to have those rights to use it according to what was in place at that time.
Any questions of Mr. Burke? Mr. Burke, thank you. We appreciate your testimony this morning and your coming for us.
My pleasure.
Jeff Herbst. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Herbst. I found out about this hearing last night from Joe when he called me and read the article in the paper, so I'm really not prepared very well, but my situation is very similar to Joe's. I bought my property in Rowena in 1985 with the understanding that it was zoned 8,000 square foot lots. Mine is the largest property there. We're deeded 6.4 acres. A couple of those are underwater, same as Joe. But it's basically, it looks like a farm, but it's not a farm. It's obviously too small. In order to grow anything there, you have to irrigate it pretty heavily. And at the time, I bought it for recreation. I had no intentions to subdivide it and sell at the time, so I wasn't interested because it would just raise your cost to subdivide because you'd pay more property taxes. Right. And they were quite steep, as you remember back then. Our millage rate in the Dalles reached 0.39 prior to property tax relief. And so our property taxes were quite high, and so I really wasn't interested in subdividing because I didn't really want to sell because it was just for recreation. But now that I'm older, I've wanted to have that opportunity, and it's very difficult because it's very large. It's much larger than any other parcel there in Rowena, which is, as Joe described, it's essentially a residential area along the river. And they made the zoning 5 acres, and I've got the largest parcel there, and it's not 5 acres of dry land. Again, I'm not interested in any monetary compensation at all. I just would like the opportunity to be able to subdivide, and I haven't got that opportunity. I do have a partner, as Joe does, and so we had always planned when we bought it together how we would divide it when we wanted to split up, but we're not able to do that either, so our only recourse is to sell it as one parcel, which is a difficult thing to do because it's very large. I go out there essentially once a week from May through October, and I'm working. I'm not recreating because it's a lot of work to maintain 4 acres of grassland. We have to irrigate and cut and try to keep down the weeds. If you don't do all that, then it's a fire hazard. There's railroad tracks there, and the trains throw sparks, and grass fires get going. And if you don't maintain your property, you're a hazard to your neighbors. So it does take a fair amount of work that I'm kind of tired of doing. And I just assume subdivide it and let some other people have smaller parcels to take care of.
Any questions, Mr. Hicks?
Mr. Chair, the freeway cuts right kind of through Rowena. Are you down close to the Columbia on your piece of property?
Correct.
Or are you up on the side?
I'm on the riverside of the railroad. The railroad tracks and the freeway go right through the middle of Rowena. And the older part of town, which used to have a town, a gas station and such, which are no longer there, are on the south side of the freeway, and we're on the north side of the tracks along the river.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Are the rules different on the other side of the freeway, where the old town used to be up there?
I don't know exactly. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer to that question. Most of those lots up there are smaller, but like Joe mentioned, I mean, if you look at Rowena, I mean, it's a lot of houses, and since I bought my property in 85, many subdivisions were done, and there are a number of less than 1 acre parcels with homes on them. And again, I'm sitting on almost 5 acres of land, and I've got neighbors that, you know, their house and driveways and stuff fill up their whole property, and they just have a little bit of grass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm probably remiss in that I didn't ask Joe this question, but I will ask you, Jeff. Does the Scenic Area Act involve your properties in any way?
Yes. I'm not exactly sure how it was all done, but Rowena, even though it's urban, was not included as an urban area. We look across the river at the town of Lyle, which is considered an urban area and then therefore excluded from the scenic area restrictions. And so we're looking at, lots of street lights and things like that. And then there's actually a point of land at the Lyle side that has not been developed because of considerable problems with the Native Americans protested any development on that property. And so it hasn't been done, although it was subdivided with the blessing of the Gorge Commission. I don't know why the Gorge Commission didn't consider us urban, because we're part of the Dalles. You know, we're Dalles Post Office, Dalles Fire Department, but we are considered inside the special management area. I believe that the county, initially any subdividing, when this moratorium was going on that Joe mentioned from 87 on, or 88, whenever it was, anything that you wanted to do, you didn't even go to the county, you had to go to the Gorge Commission. And then once the Gorge Commission kind of said, okay, these are the rules we want you to work under, then the county took it over and they changed the zoning to 5 acres. So now you just go directly to the county. You don't have to deal with the Gorge Commission. But they have changed the zoning. And again, we were not given, I mean, you were warned, but not by the federal government, you better subdivide now. It was basically, you know, other people that were against the federal government even being involved in the Columbia River Gorge, who said to us landowners, this is a bad deal, you don't want to have the federal government involved in your life. And I was for the whole idea of the Columbia Gorge Scenic Act. I felt that the cliffs and the green areas and all that should be preserved, because it's such a fabulous place. And I couldn't imagine that this one area of homes would be so adversely affected. You know, we're not that. We're not the big green cliffs, and we're not right now the gorge is hemmed in by freeways and roads and railroad tracks, and this one bedroom community of 20 homes, I just don't see that it made any sense. And so I really wasn't concerned about it at the time. I was rather naive. But really, once the bill was passed, that was it. It was over. We haven't had any opportunity to do anything about it. And again, I bought it with 8,000 square foot lots. And I have zero interest in doing that. I'd like to subdivide it into two or four parcels and only, you know, have my own house there to take care of and a yard instead of all this acreage. I hope I was clear, because I wasn't prepared. I just heard about this last night.
Since you've owned the property, how many land use, government land use organizations have you had to deal with?
Well, personally, I haven't had to because I haven't done anything, but it really was the Columbia Gorge Commission, which was formed, it was the bi-state thing that was formed, and for a period of time, everything had to go through them, and that was really very difficult for the people that did deal with them.
This is for the benefit of downstate people like myself that
right.
don't have a lot of background in
it. Yeah, it was a very difficult time. I mean, you couldn't do anything without their permission. You couldn't paint your house. And even now, you have to get permission to paint your house, but you just go to the county. You don't have to go to the commission to get permission to paint your house. But
that's
I mean, they
nice.
Were. It was pretty wild. I mean, our neighbors built a quite a nice house, and it's all natural wood on the outside, but the window trim was dark green, and the Gorge Commission initially refused him, saying that dark green was not an earth tone. Well, who knows? It was pretty bad for a while, and it's much better now. You know, you deal directly with the county, but nonetheless, the zoning was changed essentially without notification. It was over a long period of time, but there was no recourse. And again, you know, back in 86, I could have subdivided easily and with their blessing, but then I would have paid much more property taxes, which were, I mean, they're quite onerous now, but at the time, the property taxes were going to chase us out of there. It was so bad. We had a property tax bill. We paid around $100,000 for the property, and 3 years later, we get a property tax bill for $20,000. And so when you're paying a fifth of what you paid for the property in a few years, and then we protested that and got it down to around, I can't remember the numbers, $12,000 or $13,000. And then with property tax relief, we're in the $10,000 range that we pay per year. I've paid more in property taxes on this property than I paid for the property since I've owned it. And I can't subdivide it.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, sir. If your property taxes are in the neighborhood of $10,000, then you get the values in the neighborhood of about $600,000.
Correct.
So the value has increased since the time you've had it from $100,000 to about $600,000.
That's correct.
What do you expect it would have increased if you still had the ability to create, say, four lots out of it? Would it have been an even greater increase?
Oh, phenomenally greater. I mean, their properties have sold, and again, I haven't tried recently, but I've had it appraised by realtors recently, and they tell me that I could probably sell it as one parcel for between $700,000 and $800,000. That would be their guess, where to start. There have been properties that are much smaller than mine that don't have the good river access that sell for in the neighborhood of 200 or have sold for 200, 250. It really would be, I mean, what people want is access to the water, and our property is quite large, so that's why we pay so much tax, but I could easily have two waterfront lots and two lots behind with river access via easements, and each one, the waterfront ones, would probably be worth close to what I could sell the whole thing as. Each one of those waterfront lots, and then the back two lots considerably more. So I would say that my loss is at least $1 million not being able to subdivide. But again, I'm not looking for any compensation. I just would like to subdivide.
Any other questions of Mr. Ertz? Jeff, thank you for coming in this morning. We appreciated hearing from you.
Evan Manuel.
And correct me on that pronunciation, Evan. I apologize.
Not a problem.
I'm an old radio guy, though. I should be doing better on these.
Chair Girard, members of the committee, my name is Evan Manville. I'm the chair of the Oregon Community Protection Coalition. We're a coalition that whose members represent over 50,000 Oregonians all across the state in every county of the state. We work to protect Oregon's neighborhoods, farmland, and environment. OCPC is strongly opposed to House Bill 2137 and other sweeping takings bills that threaten what makes Oregon special. While you heard on Tuesday some of the difficulties with such bills, my role here is to play heretic and to question the premise on which these bills are supposedly based, which is that they implement the desires of Oregonians, as indicated through their vote on ballot measure 7 in 2000. I'll briefly ask three questions. First, is there a strong voter mandate? In 2000, measure 7 did pass by a 53-47% vote. Out of all Oregonians, that meant 23% voted for it, 20% voted against it, and 57% didn't vote on it. Either they're not voters or they didn't vote. And a reminder that the 2000 ballot contained 26 measures and a voter's pamphlet that was larger than most rural communities' telephone books. So, is this vote margin large enough to compel action on the issue, putting aside for the moment what the issue is? Well, Measure 7's chief supporters, Oregonians in Action, argues in their most recent newsletter that in close elections there is no mandate. They say, even though Kevin Mannix ran a strong race and didn't win, he denied Ted Kulongoski any kind of mandate. This is a generally accepted principle. Whether there's a mandate depends in part on the election margin. In addition to that, we face a very different state than we did in 2000. Both voters and legislators are more wary of new mandates that put burdens on taxpayers and governments and create expansive new bureaucracy. Are we seeing a grassroots revolt because Measure 7 was thrown out by the courts? Or is there even spirited public debate, as there is on PERS, school funding, or taxes? I don't believe there is. Does it serve some interest to proclaim there is? I believe it does. Saying you reject my answer to the first question, that there, and you believe there is a strong voter mandate, are we compelled to act? Well, throughout Oregon's initiative history, we've struggled with a balance between direct democracy and a republic representative form of government. We know the strong voter mandate that voters said on Measure 24 recently, that they're really concerned about dentures. Is this true? I don't believe so. So while the Measure 7 vote is informative and is an important piece of information, I don't believe it compels us to act in any certain way. And I think Oregonians in Action and the people who drafted this bill seem to hold that belief as well. In 1998, Oregonians in Action placed Measure 65 on the ballot. It's an attempt to revise how we make statewide administrative rules. Voters rejected it. Ignoring that, Oregonians in Action put it back on the ballot in 2000. Voters rejected it even more. Yet, Oregonians in Action continues to work to change how administrative rules are made. And Section 9 of House Bill 2137, the bill that we're facing today, also tries to limit this power. So clearly, we do not always follow exactly what the voters want. Even if you reject my answer to that question, the critical third question is, what should the legislature do? First, the legislature should implement more popular measures first. If you're trying to do what the voters want, and there's a chart on page 2 that shows a host of measures that have been tossed out in the 1990s and 2000. All of those measures, except for Measure 8, which was PERS reform and part of that was tossed out, were more popular than Measure 7. Most of those dealt with campaign finance reform and in some ways another dealt with term limits. And only Measure 40 has been acted upon. All the others remain stagnant, despite margins significantly larger than Measure 7. The second thing you should do, the legislature should understand, and this is probably the most critical part of my testimony, understands what the voters were and were not voting for. Soon after the election, in November 2000, OCPC conducted polls and focus groups about the issues regarding Measure 7, and we found many things. A couple of highlights. First, the average Oregonian does not understand existing takings law, and some voted for Measure 7 under the impression that the government can currently condemn property and not pay for it. That is, they don't understand the existing constitutional protections in both the U.S. and Oregon Constitution and thought that they were creating those. A second finding was, when discussing Measure 7 and these related concepts, voters were drawing upon anecdotes generally not related to land use planning. Now, we've kind of thought this was about land use all the time, but where come with that? You know, when we actually talked to the people and said, what are you thinking about? One woman, you know, several people mentioned federal laws, the Endangered Species Act and others. Another person said she voted for Measure 7 because, well, when a Kmart was going to be built nearby and decreased her property value, she would be paid. Now, clearly, that's almost the opposite of what Measure 7 would have done, but that's what some voters were voting for. I'm not going to deny that lots of voters are concerned about land use planning, but the question is, what were they saying in Measure 7? It's not surprising that voters may not have connected Measure 7 and land use planning, because the following words did not appear in Measure 7 or in the ballot title: land use, zoning, farmland, forest land, single-family dwelling, or planning. None of those were in the measure or in the description. The unsuccessful campaign to defeat the measure focused on its cost, not its impact to land use planning. And in fact, Measure 7 would have encompassed a sweeping set of regulations. And a second attachment lists some of those. So without better information, I think it can only be our own worldview rather than a clear message from the voter that allows us to define a Measure 7 vote as a clarion call to dramatically overhaul land use planning. We have to be very careful not to create realities that aren't there. I'm almost done. The third thing you could do, the legislature could simply do what Measure 7 supporters told voters it would do: make Oregon law conform with the U.S. Constitution. In the 2000 election, supporters of Measure 7 distributed a voter's guide to all voters. I don't know if any of you remember it. And in this voter guide, they described Measure 7. They wrote, "Measure 7 simply brings Oregon law into conformance with the U.S. Constitution by requiring governments to pay just compensation to a property owner if the government deprives the landowner of meaningful use of his or her property." That was their description. Of course, Measure 7 was far more sweeping than that. But did the voters know? Many, I fear, did not know. So perhaps, you know, that's all that some of the voters wanted Measure 7 to do: follow the U.S. Constitution. So as we go forward, as we examine this issue, I would advise committee members to be wary of those who use the Measure 7 vote to move their own ends. While I agree that most Oregonians believe in the abstract concept of fairness, we have other concerns that need to be weighed. And I think we can protect all those concerns, but House Bill 2137 is not a way to do it. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Manville?
I'd like to make a response to one point.
Certainly,
Mr. Manville, I'd like to just mention that, one, we're sworn to uphold the Constitution and not merely to consider popular issues. In fact, we have the requirement that we deal with unpopular issues and try and do what's right. In the consideration of this bill, we have to focus not only on what the majority of the people might want to do, but by the very nature of our Constitution, we must make sure that we protect the minority and their rights as well. And primarily, we have a major consideration for those who have had property that has been lost, or the value or the ability to use it has been lost without due process of law and notification. We appreciate very much your coming in and your explanations, but I just wanted to mention to you that it goes far beyond merely what the majority of the Americans might want us to do on this particular issue, or Oregonians on this particular issue, because we're duty-bound to protect individuals in their individual rights and not merely stick our finger up and say, well, what is the wind of majority viewpoint at this point? If that were the case, we wouldn't have civil rights. We'd still have slavery. I mean, there'd be so many issues. We know that this is not the same, but I just wanted to mention to you that we are very much concerned about the vote on Measure 7, but we have to deal with the issue as it applies not only to majority but also to the minority, the property holders themselves.
Thank you, Representative. I don't mean to be facetious in asking you this next question, but you represent the Oregon Community Protection Coalition, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
What are you protecting from whom?
Chair Girard, the Oregon Community Protection Coalition is formed to protect our neighborhoods, our farmland, and our environment in a general sense. And that depends, you know, and it's mainly applied to Measure 7 type issues. And we believe that we're trying to be the voice of fairness. And being the voice of fairness has a lot of dimensions, and we think that some of them have been mentioned today, but there's fairness to taxpayers, there's fairness to other property owners who are impacted by development going in, there's fairness to the environment, there's fairness to the community. So I know that's a bit abstract, but that's what we do.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Manville? Thank you very much.
Thanks for
coming in. Don Schellenberg. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Generally speaking, the Farm Bureau supports the land use planning system, and we do that for three particular reasons. Number one, to protect the natural resources of land and water for the purpose of farming. And that's basically the purpose of the EFU zone, to accomplish that. Number two, to prevent conflict from non-farm uses. And 2 days ago, before this committee, I talked about the conflicts and what we're looking for there. And we want to allow agriculture to continue to farm without harming the public, without disturbing the public, I should say, while we do our normal farming activities. And then third, to ensure a viable agriculture infrastructure. And when you're talking about an infrastructure, as I mentioned the other day, you're in some cases talking about a critical land mass in order to support those suppliers, processors, and markets that you need. Farm Bureau policy also calls for compensation for loss of value. And in that context, actually our policy is in the context of financial compensation. We are in the farm zone. We're doing the activity that we're supposed to be doing in that farm zone. And Senate Bill 100 and the package of bills that brought land use planning into place actually provided for compensation for loss of value. And most farmers and ranchers lost anywhere from a quarter to a half of their value when they were placed inside an EFU zone, when that became an actual reality. And I'm going to say that, in fact, it wasn't a future value that they were looking at that they lost. They lost actual cash opportunity at the time. Farmers and ranchers often have to borrow for their operating costs. Not very many farmers have a bank account that they can go out and purchase all their supplies and or expand their operation, if that's what they need to do, from existing resources. And so they go to the bank and they ask for an operating loan. And the bank looks at their property and they look at the value of the property and they make a determination whether or not they can there's enough value there that they're comfortable in making that loan. And when land use planning came into place, immediately the opportunity to borrow operating capital decreased. So farmers actually had a cash loss value on the spot when that happened. So that's one reason that financial compensation is an important aspect for farmers and ranchers on this issue. Well, sadly, that compensation never materialized under that earlier package of bills, and I suspect that's part of the reason for Measure 7, that's part of the reason for House Bill 2137 today. But House Bill 2137 is a mixed bag from our perspective. It begins by allowing for compensation, but then it moves to allowance of alternative form of compensation, and those alternative form of compensation is variance in the land use laws. Now, in the agricultural zone, that causes some concern because when you allow that variance, what that does then is that those variances allow the consumption of natural resources by other than agricultural producers. And so it begins to harm us in that manner. It allows potential conflict to come in because those will normally be non-farm uses that will come into the agricultural community. And then you begin to have conflict with agricultural practices. And then in addition, it weakens the agricultural infrastructure by taking land out of actual farm use. And so the infrastructure then begins to weaken. Other parts of the bill are not compensation related, but they allow land uses that would be detrimental to agriculture, the same ones that I just spoke of. My comments indicate today the impact on the EFU zone. Now, there may very well be practical application for these kinds of compensations inside the urban growth boundary or in other non-farm zones, and we have no quarrel with that. I'm not aware of what those are. I'm not sure that we maybe have heard some of those today where there is rationale for providing alternative methods of compensation, and we wouldn't have a problem with that outside the EFU zone. This may be the first bill addressing this issue. It probably is not the last bill that will come along to address this issue, so I would encourage the committee to go slow, be deliberate, make sure you understand what all the ramifications are when you do make a decision on how you want to handle the bill or how you want to amend the bill or what kind of actions you take. Well, with that, I would be happy to answer any questions or try to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions, Mr. Schellenberg? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I think your advice is well taken, that your cautionary advice, and that, as you state, we should proceed in deliberate fashion, and I'm sure we're going to do that. And also, you suggest we know the full consequences of our action. In terms of the consequences, you mentioned that certain farm values may have, land values may have dropped from one quarter to one half of value as a result of land use restrictions. We would need to know the full consequences of that. Do you have a dollar figure in mind, or is that a dollar figure which you could provide to us at a later date? I'm thinking of something in terms of an estimate or a high to a low.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I don't have any figures. That would vary from farm to farm. In fact, the decrease in the value is going to depend on how close or how far away you are from an urban area. The closer you are to the urban area, the more value that landowner lost, because there was always the expectation before land use planning law that we have, there was always the expectation, you know, that someday that may be developed. And the closer you are to the urban area, the sooner that might happen, the higher the price of that value. You get out 20 miles, 30, 40, 50 miles from an urban area, probably didn't have much effect because there wasn't any expectation that that would be developed for hundreds of years, maybe. And so it just varies all over the board.
The follow-up question then, Mr. Chairman, then your assertion that the values have been depreciated from one quarter to one half value, at least for the purposes of this hearing, is speculative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Mr. Schellenberg? Seeing none, Don, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your testimony. Linda Ludwig. We'll continue to take testimony until 10:30, and then we'll just have to continue our testimony taking to Tuesday, and I'll have to apologize again to all of those of you who have signed up, but I can assure you that this committee will continue to take public testimony until everyone has had an opportunity to speak. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. I'd like to thank you today for the opportunity to give some general comments about HB 2137. Again, these comments are general in nature. I'm more than happy to bring in some of our elected officials and city planners to talk to you in detail about this issue if you would like. A bit of background about the League of Oregon Cities. Our membership includes 238 of Oregon's 240 cities, representing about 2 million people in Oregon. All cities with more than 20 residents are members of the League. And the mission of the League, which was founded in 1925, is to strengthen and support livable communities. The League has supported and continues to support a solution to Oregon's property rights issues that is fair to property owners and our communities as a whole, reasonable in terms of costs and practical to implement. And we very much continue to commit to working with you to that end. As a member of the work group that worked on this issue last session, I'd like to begin by acknowledging what Representative Williams said about the complexity of the issue on Tuesday while trying to simplify my own comments for you on this issue. The role that cities fundamentally play in this issue with regard to land use regulations is to balance the right of private property owners with the rights of community residents. We believe that citizens rely on their elected officials to pass laws that fairly consider and balance the rights of private property owners against the needs of the city. As you know, for more than 25 years, Oregon has been heralded for its statewide planning program, which seeks to encourage growth inside the urban growth boundaries, inside the UGB, and protect its valuable resource lands from development. Most of the regulatory implementation of the system takes place on the local level. In other words, and I want to make this point very clearly, the rubber meets the road locally. We are the implementers of the land use planning system. Local elected officials invite citizens to participate in identifying community goals, listen to their input, adopt laws, such as zoning ordinances, to implement these goals. Some of these laws invariably, inevitably restrict the use of private property. Without such restrictions, land could be put to any use to which the private property owner desired, with no regard for its impact on surrounding properties. That being said, we also need to recognize that government or governmental regulations, can both increase and decrease a private property owner's value. For instance, government can increase property value by putting in an interchange, a new park, or open space that increases value to property owners. Government also brings value to private property owners through the adoption of regulations. For instance, let's take an example. What happens to a piece of property that was formerly outside the urban growth boundary, UGB, and it's brought inside? Property that could have formerly been valued at $1 million often is raised tenfold, or $10 million. Then other land use restrictions are applied to that same piece of property, such as zoning provisions, and now that property's value is reduced to $2 million. I'm asking, should this be construed as a taking? In this example, the direct actions of government doubled that property owner's value. Measure 7 said that if a government passes a law that restricts the use of private property and that law reduces the value of property, the private property owner is to be compensated equivalent to the loss of value. The debate really arises in how far we go in compensating individual property owners when laws have been passed which protect the welfare of a community as a whole and oftentimes increase the private property value. Another example of the complexity of the givings, takings issue that you might want to consider. A zoning restriction that requires single-family residential homes reduces the value of property below what it would be if it was zoned commercial. But that zoning restriction prevents a McDonald's from being located adjacent to someone's, maybe your home, your own home. Should government have to pay for that restriction on use? A restriction on a particular parcel when viewed in isolation, and this is a very important point, that may decrease the value of a lot. But that same restriction applied to all property within a subdivision or a PUD can create value for all of those lots. HB 2137 would require government to pay that McDonald's for that restriction. So, in history, after the passage of Measure 7, the LEAF board looked at adopting several principles that they, we could evaluate legislation against in working through what we did last session. And real quickly, I'll just throw out those principles for you today. A reasonable scope, a prospective view. The regulator should be the payer. New revenue to meet new demands. A statutory rather than constitutional approach. And a fair, locally controlled claims process. And we can talk about that in detail at another time if you'd like. Where do we go from here? Aside from only a couple of states that require compensation for takings beyond the bar that's set by the U.S. Constitution, a few of those states require compensation. Most of them do not. Many of them require a compensation impact statement or some sort of financial assessment or disclosure for any new rule or restriction prior to adoption. That's prior to adoption locally, prior to adoption legislatively. The statement is made available to the public and is duly considered by elected officials before they adopt or enact any new regulations or restrictions. States that have gone this route have found this to be a fairly effective method of reducing the burden of governmental restrictions that reduce value to property owners without bankrupting either the state or local governments. The Measure 7 work group that spent all last session behind closed doors soon discovered that the rural and urban issues play out somewhat differently. Also, I want to point out politically, the rural issues seem to be the primary driver of what we're looking at as the takings issue in this state. We did see Oregonians in Action strongly position themselves during last session regarding lots of record. And perhaps, it would be more effective to first deal with the issues, these issues, independent of a more broadly defined takings legislation. Those issues could be an expanded lot of record and perhaps right to subdivide. I'd also add that on the urban side of the equation, the pressure valve that's driving this issue seems to be the local permitting process. Again, it may be much more effective to deal with these issues straight up rather than trying to wrap it under the guise of takings. My file in the office for Measure 7 and all of what we ran through last session is probably 2 feet high off the floor. When we started, even when we were midway through last session, the questions and complexity of this issue are amazing. I have 3 pages here of questions that we started maybe 3 months into it. And some of those things would be, you know, the scope, land use only, real property only, broader interpretations with exceptions. What do we do with environmental issues and regulations, including conditions of approval attached to a land use application or permit, include urban-rural lot of record claims, perspective from when? The regulator should be the payer. What about federal compliance issues, state compliance, exemptions for state or local actions which implements a federal requirement, or exemptions for local actions which implements a state requirement? You look at determination of value loss and the appraisal methods. I know Representative Williams got a little bit into this the other day. Do you include the use, the market amount, feasibility, before, after regulations, minimum and maximum percentage thresholds, a value determination over a certain time period, a value determination of takings, net of givings? Is it based on the universal application of a regulation or for just one property owner? Is it based, the value determination, on multiple rate restrictions or regulations or just one? The list goes on and on and on when we look at takings. Perhaps more importantly, I'd like to say if the legislature chooses to try to solve these issues by passing new takings legislation, that new resources or new revenue sources to pay for compensation are very much a driving issue. Even if you look through this with a perspective-only view, especially given the challenging times that we are in both with state and local governments at this time. I have a couple of comments here to the bill itself, if there's time to take those.
Certainly.
Whichever I.
Take whatever time you need, Linda.
Okay,
up
thank
till
you.
10:30.
To the bill, as you all say, a couple of comments here. The bill looks like 2137. These are issues that the lever would be concerned with. It's not perspective only. It's tied to the November 2000 election date. There's a 10% threshold. This is very low given that there would likely be some substantiation of value loss, which would likely, although it's not spelled out in the bill, be some sort of an appraisal in which the margins of error easily could reach 10%. The action is filed in circuit court, which would have limited information to reliably apportion responsibility. One of the issues that we looked at in depth is who handles restrictions or laws that could be state and local combined. Someone's going to need to apportion both the claims responsibility and the financial responsibility for those actions. Of course, there's a concern of current lack of funding in the circuit courts and court case overload. Section 4, sub 4, 2 years is too long a financial window to be open for local governments to be able to budget for claim exposure. Section 5, 2, sub B, terms like reasonable investment-backed expectations are too broad and not very well defined. What does reasonable mean here? It's very arbitrary. Section 5, sub 3, sub B, condemnation as a compensation method doesn't give us a new resource. It's not realistic or a practical method to compensate property owners. Section 6 and Section 7, lot of record and the subdivision portions of this bill, these should be separate issues. They did tie up agreements at the end of the 01 session, as I said. These should be separate issues and looked at separately. Section 10, this presumably allows multiple types of claims, both federal and state or federal and local, that both could be compensated, resulting in a double remedy or double compensation. What's missing in 2137, at first glance here, there's no provision for a claims process or an appeals process. And very, very importantly, there's no new funding source in this bill. Also passed out to you is a letter from the City of Albany addressed to Representative Betsy Close. And I'd like to read just a small portion of the letter for the record and for the committee. I believe you have a copy of it. Dear Representative Close, I understand that you provided testimony to the House Committee this week with regard to your support of HB 2137. As mayor of the largest city in your district, I need you to be aware that I have serious concerns with this bill as presently written. My guess is that the other cities in your district would also share these concerns. And the point that Mayor McLaren brings out here, I think, is a very important one. He's talking about the retroactive portion of the bill. This is far too much time has passed to expect that local governments have not had to move ahead with land use decisions in compliance with their periodic review requirements under state law. The city of Albany, for example, has been in periodic review for the past 5 years, and we have been diligently moving ahead with our revisions to our comprehensive plan and development code throughout much of that time. While no one has raised serious Measure 7 concerns about the revisions, the standards for raising a takings claim in this bill, such as the 10% reduction in the value and the retroactive date, go too far in encouraging claims that could be devastating to either the integrity of our planning process or to our limited budget, depending on how the claims are resolved. The end result would be to make a mockery of the thousands of hours of citizen participation, staff work, and elected official efforts. We have worked endlessly, and our local officials do, to balance the concerns of the many stakeholders to our comprehensive planning efforts, including property owners, to give property owners another bite of the apple long after the fact, and when they are encouraged to do so by some late act of the state legislature, simply sends the wrong message about the statewide planning program. And they also raise the concern that the two-year time frame for raising a takings claim is very difficult for us to be able to budget. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. Please use the League and myself as a resource as you continue to walk through this issue.
Any questions of Ms. Ludwig? Representative Ackerman.
Just for clarification for the record, could you inform us how many municipalities constitute the League of Oregon Cities?
238 cities.
And in your work with the Measure 7 issues, are you aware that any of these municipalities have any financial resources to pay the potential liability as expressed in this bill?
Chair Farrar, Representative Ackerman, no.
Thank you.
Linda, I was also, the testimony that we've heard this morning, there seemed that one particular thing has, to me, been repeated over and over in each case, and that is a lack of notification. Does notification vary from municipality to municipality today, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? How has that changed, or has it changed? And what are the present requirements of a municipality in regards to notification?
Chair Girard, yes, it has changed, and I think that you'll maybe remember Measure 56 with the notification to private property owners. It's a requirement for both the state and local governments, and that, I'm probably not going to bring out the date accurately, but I believe that was passed in the 1997 session. And there are other people in the audience here that could tell you with more certainty if that's the right date. There is, yes, notification for property owners prior to that time is probably something that didn't happen as reliably as it does today.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was actually going to ask the same question and a related one, which is, it seems like another theme is people believe that they've had the rules changed on them in midstream. In other words, that you should be able to use your property under the same terms and conditions that were in effect at the time you bought it. And I don't know whether you have any general comments on that principle as to how it relates to the ability of local governments to look out for their citizens.
Chair Girard, Representative Rosenbaum, I do have a few comments. The first would be this issue, as you heard this morning consistently, hits outside our UGBs 90% of the time. It's much more of a rural issue when you bought your property for the use, whether you're going to divide it or what you're going to do with that time period and how rules have changed since that time. Yes, the land use planning program in these last years, there have been many, many, many more rules and restrictions on the urban side of what we do with that. I'd like to be an expert in that, but I'm not. I've kind of honed down to what I can handle inside the UGB. But again, I think this points out, we heard concerns today that weren't necessarily directed towards takings. They were directed perhaps to the $80,000 test. We heard other concerns that I would throw out. Maybe those particular issues need to be dealt with on face value rather than trying to take this all in as a takings umbrella.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ludwig.
Thank you.
Ron Eber. And I noticed Bob Rendy here also this morning to recognize you, sir. We have 15 minutes, so I hope that we can accommodate you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be brief. I'm Bob Rendy, legislative coordinator with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and with me, Ron Eber, our farm forest specialist, has looked in detail at the provisions of this bill. Before he goes into that, I just wanted to make a couple of brief remarks. First of all, of course, as you've heard a number of times, this same issue ended up last session in a long work group that we were involved in, and we would certainly agree to do so again. But I want to make sure that it's understood that either this bill either means that we have a method to come up with the compensation that it talks about, or I'm afraid, in terms of the way the negotiations went last session, that the alternative is to relax regulations. And either of those choices are I think where we're going to end up. If the result is a relaxation of regulations, the concern that the department has in our particular role in this debate is that a number of statutes, especially 197 and 215, ORS 197 and 215, required the Land Conservation and Development Commission to carry out over the last 30 years a program to achieve a number of things, including farm forest protection, Willamette Greenway protection, coastal protection, and economic development and urban growth boundaries. And all of these things, I think, are, and ultimately, as we look back, as this bill does, at issue here. And so we want everybody to understand that if the course that's chosen, if you do not find a funding source for these takings claims, if the choice instead is a relaxation of regulations, that we need to be clear to you and at the table to indicate how that's going to affect the mandate that's in statute for LCDC. And I think LCDC over the last 30 years has tried to carry that out to the best of their ability, understanding how controversial it is. So with that, Ron will speak to the bill itself, but that's kind of our position here at this point, is we're going to be trying to understand how this affects what the legislature wants the state to do with regard to the broad mandate for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Bob mentioned, I'm Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the department. I have looked at the bill. We simply wanted to indicate that although we have concerns as it is drafted, we recognize the legislature and many interest groups want to discuss and work on this issue, and we stand ready to be part of that effort, and we would request to participate in any work group that explores this issue further. In terms of the bill itself, without getting into all the details, since it doesn't appear anyone's digging into that at this level, we simply, in the analysis provided, looked at the bill and would note that it really it's almost three separate bills or three separate parts in how it addresses the compensation issue. The sections 3 and 4 deal with the compensation issue directly, and sets a standard for that. Then in section 5, it really sets up an additional separate process with an authority for local government to waive or modify existing land use standards based on a different standard than the one in sections 3 and 4. So notwithstanding the fact, as I read the bill, and the drafters may have intended something differently, but as I read it now, you could get compensated under sections 3 and 4, then based on this additional standard about reasonable deprivation of value, be able to get a waiver to the land use regulation that in fact you were compensated for. Then the latter sections of the bill, sections 6, 7, and 8, have been referred to as a lot of record or subdivide partition of record provisions. And those, again, are in addition to the other ones. So you could get compensated. You could either get a waiver to the existing regulation or would be eligible for a lot of record to build a dwelling or to divide and get additional dwellings. With regard to the lot of record provisions, those would have significant effects on the land base, urban and rural, in the state in terms of development. I would note that there are existing provisions that allow dwellings, and there's an existing statutory provision for a lot of record that was developed by the legislature in 1993 with House Bill 3661, and that was a revision from a previous lot of record law from back in the 80s. So the legislature at different times has looked at the lot of record issue and what was deemed to be fair at that point in time, and has changed the law. Finally, I would simply note there have been references today from people testifying to farm dwelling standards, non-farm dwelling standards, template dwelling standards. As the staff person who oversees those, if you have questions on how those work, where they came from, I'd be more than glad to try and answer your questions with that regard. So at this point, we would like to participate in any effort that continues this discussion about compensation and looking at existing regulations and assist you in understanding whatever changes, what the impact of any changes might be, either to the existing regulations or to the land base. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, if I could add a couple of things. I think you've heard a little bit about this already, but we were asked to estimate the cost of this bill, as usually happens as a department, and we simply don't have the expertise to do that. And I think that question needs to be studied carefully, and I'm not sure who you would try and appoint to do that. Last session we estimated it in the millions. We noted that ballot measure 7 estimated the effect of this to be in the billions. That's such a wide span that if indeed you are to be seeking a funding source and want to go forward with this, I hope that there's careful attention to who you select to try and do those estimates to make sure that in the end you have an adequate funding source. One other thing about looking back at regulations, it's enormously difficult to know what a landowner might have been allowed to do, say, in 1983. You have had probably a number of changes to staff. The county in question may have changed its ordinances a number of times, and those records may not be there. The exact interpretation of those provisions may have been changed a number of times by court cases. I don't want anyone to underestimate how enormously difficult it's going to be to decide what a landowner was entitled to. As you go back in time, and the further back you go, the more difficult that's going to be.
Thank you, Bill. Ron, I can assure you that we accept your request that you be included in any further work group in that area. Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Ackerman.
No questions.
Representative Greenler.
Mr. Chair. Could you give us a little history? I was very taken by the sister's case and the question of the development of what appropriate farm use is, the 80,000. Where did that come from, say, the time of their, in 1988 on? Has that changed? Was it an original in the regs out of SB 100? Have things changed along the way? Can you just run through that?
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlick, there have been changes. When Senate Bill 100, when Goal 3 dealing with agricultural lands was adopted, it incorporated as a requirement the use of the statutory exclusive farm use zone that the legislature had originally adopted in 1963, which had a provision allowing for dwellings customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. And that standard, again, was incorporated in Senate Bill 101, which tied the zoning more closely with the farm assessment provisions that are on the books. So the counties initially were applying a standard case by case to determine if a dwelling was customarily provided in conjunction with farm use, and they all did it a little differently. Some required a farm management plan and some did not. And there was a study in the late 90s that looked at a number, the legislature funded a study that looked at the approvals counties had made statewide on the basis of the farm management plans, and I don't remember the exact percentage. I could come back at another time, and I have the details of that study, that most of the properties were not doing any farming. So the commission, the Land Conservation Development Commission, appointed a task force, and coming out of the 93 session, developed more clear and objective standards for the approval of farm dwellings. So on high-value farmland, which is the best farmland in the state, there is the property or the farm has to have produced $80,000 in gross income from farming in the past two or three of the last 5 years. On non-high-value farmland, which is about three-fourths of the farmland in the state, it's a $40,000 test, or there's a capability test, or if you have 160 acres and you're farming, you can get the dwelling. At the same time, as I believe the gentleman from Sisters pointed out, he had applied for what is called a non-farm dwelling. And if you can show that the property or a portion of the property is generally unsuitable for the production of farm crops and livestock, you can get a dwelling. And I'd be more than glad to discuss that issue with him. Deschutes County has one of the more unique and different systems for how they have zoned their farmland and how they approve farm dwellings, and they actually approve most of the non-farm dwellings in the state, so it was I'd be interested to see why that approval wasn't made at the county level. But back to your question, there have been changes. The standard for the income standard, where the commission was trying to get to a more clear and objective way of deciding when do we have a producing commercial farm versus a dwelling that's a rural residence and distinguish it from a non-farm related dwelling, they set that standard, and that was in 1994.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I know we'll see you again.
Thank you.
We're just about out of time, but I'm down to Randy Tucker and Dave Honeycutt, which
really holds me.
Wow,
we'll hear from them.
How lucky does a guy get? You know,
let them hold hands.
What I would like to ask both of you is on Tuesday of next week, if we pretty well set aside Tuesday of next week and gave you each an hour, you don't need that. Good. Okay.
Do we get to vote on that?
How much time, Randy, would you feel would be adequate? Because we really want. I would like the committee to have testimony from both of you at the same time on the same day, so that we can sit and see it all at one time. How much time would be appropriate for you? Yes, please. And you have to tell us who you are.
Mr. Chair, Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. It depends on what you want to achieve in the hearing, because I was prepared to make some relatively broad general comments today, which would take 10, 15 minutes or something like that. But you know, several of the things I would say have been said, and I would just touch on them lightly when I come up. And also, it's not clear to us that this bill is the actual text that we're going to be working from, or if there's more, you know, if there's a lot of discussion before we get down to specifics. And so I wouldn't necessarily plan to take an hour, but okay, certainly, you know, 15 minutes or so.
Well, I just threw that at you to kind of knock you off.
Yeah, that's, you know, you know, you give me an hour, sometimes I can fill it when I don't think I will. But
well, that's total time, Randy, in the next 6-7 months.
Oh, okay. There we go. then I'm in trouble.
Dave, what I think I would like to have is both of you to educate this committee as to the basic issue and intent of Measure 7. Back to back, so to speak. And I don't know, you guys can flip a coin as to who goes first.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Given the radio program that I do Mondays through Wednesday, I won't be able to be here on Tuesday until about 9 o'clock anyway. So if Randy wants to go first, that's fine by me. And when I get here, if he's finished, then I'll start. And if
right,
he's not...
Well, what we'll do then...
Ross can keep tabs on what I'm saying.
We'll set aside from 8:30 to 9:30 for your presentation and then allow some time for questions from the committee on Tuesday morning.
Okay, great.
We'll look forward. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for accommodating us. We will continue the public testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ben Rose. I'm the president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, and I'm wondering if it would be possible for us to present the material which we do intend to bring to this committee at that same time, perhaps if you could give us 20 minutes or half an hour at that 9:30 slot on the same day, we would certainly welcome that opportunity.
So be it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming forward. And if there are other organizations who wish to make any presentation on Tuesday as part of this, please contact our administrator and we'll try to accommodate your wishes. We will continue on Tuesday at 8:30 our public testimony on 2137, but for today we are adjourned.